be seated. All right. I love that song so much, just the words of it. When you really think about, I raise a hallelujah of what we do, that's just our response. I mean, our worship does not give us anything. It's who we're worshiping. We're worshiping God, and the song says the King is alive, and that's where we find our hope. There's a lot of people going through a lot of hard stuff. I've had some pretty tough conversations with people this week, and just to try to help them to see that, you know, going through the circumstances, it's terrible. There are some really hard things right now, but stay close to God. I mean, remember what he's done for us. This is where our hope's from, not because things are going well or we got through this or this result came back good. Our hope is because of Jesus, that he is alive, and even death couldn't stop him. So, all right, that wasn't my sermon at all. I just liked the song. We're actually in the Ten Commandments series. We're in the second week of 10, and I say that, the second week of 10, not 10 weeks. We're only going to be doing this for 4 weeks, but the series is called 10, the Ten Commandments. I know everyone's probably at least has an idea of what they are. It's a list of laws or rules from God to the Israelites. But if you weren't here last week, I feel like I need to do a quick recap. We started last week, we did not look at a single rule, but we started the chapter with the Ten Commandments. It's Exodus chapter 20, and I'm just going to use the verses we used last week to kind of recap that. It says in verse 1, "And God spoke all these words, 'I am the Lord your God, who brought you out of Egypt, out of the land of slavery.'" And so the first thing God did before he said, "Hey, here's these rules that you follow, and if you mess up the rules, then you're out." He didn't do that. He said, "I am your God." He established the relationship. "This is who I am to you. I'm your God. You're my people, and I love you." And he said, "You know, you may not trust me, but here's what I did for you." He reminded them that he got them out of slavery, that he gave them the promised land. And he said, okay, or he promised the promised land to them. But anyway, what he was doing was saying, okay, this what I'm about to do, this list, take it in the context of our relationship, of me being a loving God to you. And so then we look at the first four. Well, that's what we're going to do today. There's 10. Like I said, we didn't look at any last week. We're going to look at 4 today. And then next week, I'm not going to tell you which one we're looking at, but you can probably already check. It's the 5th one. Next week's Father's Day, so I thought this is perfect. We're gonna look at the 5th commandment on Father's Day, and then we'll look at the number 6 through 10 in a couple weeks here. But today, these first 4, it's all about our relationship with God and our acknowledgement of him. A relationship and our acknowledgement of God. And I hope to answer 2 questions this morning. And I have a little bit more than what I did last service, because after the service, I had a conversation with a couple of guys, and they helped me to see, well, maybe this wasn't explained more in depth, or I still have questions. So I'm going to try to answer questions at the same time. But the main idea is what do the commandments tell us about God? So we're going to go through 1 through 4, and we're going to read 1, and then I'm going to say, here's what I think this tells us about who God is based off of what he said. Last week we had this idea, you learn a lot about someone by the rules, right? If a parent sets a rule about not jumping off the house, it's because they care about your safety, not because they're just trying to have hard rules, you know? So you learn about what matters. The second question later, and this is just how we're going to close this morning, is what do they mean for us today? All right, so first commandment, we're just going to jump right in. Number 1, Exodus 20, verse 3, "You shall have no other gods before me." So he starts with that. I'm going to explain this a little bit more after the second commandment, but I want to share some of the meaning now. See, when we read this, "You shall have no other God before me," what do you think of when you think of the phrase "before me"? That it just means first. Right? First, and then whatever, second, third, fourth, whatever, that's fine. But in the ancient world, what they did, they would call on a certain god, and if I could put a picture of it, I would put a lowercase g, a false god, a man-made god, and if they needed something specific, they would go to a specific god. They had many gods. So like Baal was the god of rain. So if they needed rain, like we need rain, they would have went to Baal. Asherah was the fertility god. If they needed her, they'd call upon her name. But the God of Israel, the one true God, says, "No, I'm not competing with the other gods. There's me, you're going to trust me, and I'm going to provide for you. And I've already proven how I've provided, because like I said, he got him out of slavery after 400 years. And so if you think about what that looks like then or now or any point in the last couple thousand years, I mean, if we just followed it like maybe how you read it with before me ranking, you would say, well, I could put Allah and Buddha and Zeus second, third, fourth, as long as I put the God of Israel, Yahweh, our God, first. And obviously that's not right. We probably wouldn't be so blunt about it, but I think we do. We do this a lot. We say, okay, well, God first, and family second, and country third, and maybe I'll put my job fourth, and my friends fifth. And sorry, friends. But anyway, but that doesn't really work. Because if it was just that, if God was one, and then two, three, four, five, whatever, is just whatever you want it to be, well, there would be an issue there, because then I would say, well, you know what, I'm going to give the first money to God. When my check comes in, I'm going to give the first to God. And when I wake up in the morning, I'm going to give my first few minutes to God. And these are good things. I'm not saying these are bad things. But if I just gave the first part of my day, and I say, you know what, Sunday, first day of the week, I'm going to start my week and I'm going to give it to God. So I'm giving my first to God, all good things. But then what if I said I'm not going to give him my second? You know, and how I treat my wife and my kids, God can stay at church for that part. Or my work, maybe I have to do things a little bit against what God says, so I'm going to leave God at church. I gave him my first, so that's okay, right? No, it doesn't work like that. So, before me, and a lot of what I'm doing this morning is I'm taking the commandments and how we read them and how I've even thought about them myself. I'm going to try to go a little bit deeper and point to what it really means or what I believe it means through studying some of this. Before me could actually mean in my presence. So instead of saying God is first, which that is also true, what this command he's saying is in my presence before me, right? So if I said, Myron, I want you to come up here before me, then what I'm asking is not to you be first and everyone else get behind him. I'm just asking you to be in my presence, right? So that's what God's saying in this command. So what does it teach us about God? I mean, really think about the context, freedom from slavery, the promised land. God rescued his people before anything else. Before he gave the rules, he rescued them. And then he asks them simply to honor his name. Exodus 9:16, he says, "But I have raised you up for this very purpose." All right, so here's why you're freed. "That I might show you my power and that my name might be proclaimed in all the earth." See, the Israelites were going to receive blessings from God. They were representing him to other people as well. People would look at the Israelites and say, "That's what their God is about. I didn't really know that." See, these commandments were to help them to do that, to represent him better. But it wasn't just follow the rules or you're out. It was a relationship, a promise, a covenant, similar to that of a marriage. You know, one man and one woman come together and they're married, right? Well, same thing with people. There's one God, not going to deal with all the others. I mean, what kind of God would he be if he said, well, you know, you worship me, but go ahead and worship the others too? What kind of husband would I be if I said to my wife, well, you're married to me, but, I mean, you can go ahead and be married to any other guy too? I mean, we wouldn't look and say, well, you're a terrible husband. Oh, a jealous husband. Oh, he'd say, you're a good and loving husband. This is what God did. Only look to him as this relationship was a covenant, a promise, and it was mutually beneficial. God created us for the purpose of loving him. And that's what these first four commandments, they're going to seem very similar but also unique at the same time, but they all point to the same thing in that we love God. Even Jesus responded to the question, which commandment's the greatest? What would you say? Most people, I think, would say probably murder. Like, well, I know there's a list of 10 there, but, and I've broken most of them, maybe, but I've never killed anyone, so I'm probably good, right? He didn't put it first, and Jesus didn't answer it that way. Matthew 22:37-40, what's the most important commandment? Jesus replied, "Love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your mind. This is the first and greatest commandment. The second is like it, love your neighbor as yourself. All the law and the prophets hang on these two commandments." Love God first. Why is this so important? We're going to get to that in just a minute here. Everything we're going to look at today is focusing on loving God. Over the next 2 weeks, we're going to look at how that carries over then into loving other people. Second commandment, verses 4 to 6. You shall not make for yourself an image in the form of anything in heaven above, or on the earth beneath, or in the waters below. You shall not bow down to them or worship them, for I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, punishing the children for the sin of the parents to the third and fourth generation of those who hate me, but showing love to 1,000 generations of those who love me and keep my commandments. All right. Some people put these first two together and say they're the same thing, and then they divide the last one, number 10. We're not going to do that. I don't think that's how it's supposed to be, but I can understand these really go together a lot. The first one, no other gods, is about religion. You have one God, that's it. This one seems to be about worship. No images. Now, I think, well, we've got a Christian flag, we've got a cross. Those aren't God. Those don't represent who God is. This building does not represent who God is. The closest thing that we have, people made in God's image. Well, we definitely don't worship people. So why was this an issue at the time to the Israelites? They tried to put him into ways to worship him that they could leave him in one spot. Like I said earlier, you compartmentalize. Well, I'm going to worship God at church, but when I go home, I don't need to worship him. I'm not in his presence. I'm not before him. And another thing that they would do, like the golden calf. They made a golden calf and tried to worship that on behalf of God, and it didn't represent him appropriately. There is no thing, there's no statue or image. There's nothing that we could possibly make that would fully show us who God is. We just couldn't do it. It would just cause more damage. For example, when the Israelites received these rules, a young bull was a symbol of strength, right? But it was also a symbol of sexual powers. I know that's a little graphic, but maybe they would have made the bull because they said, you know what? Our God is a strong God, so we're going to make this bull and we're going to worship it to show that God is strong. And then someone else, not an Israelite, walks by and they see that bull and they think, wow, they're worshiping a God of sexual powers. This doesn't make sense. I'm not going to worship that God. Right, they misrepresented him. And then in this is the one with the blessing and the curse in a way. It says, punishing the children for the sin of the parents to the third and fourth generation of those who hate me, but showing love to 1,000 generations of those who love me and keep my commandments. All right, so that phrase, it was a common phrase used. It was not meant to be a specific time period. It was meant to say that it would be ongoing. Breaking God's law in one generation would hurt the next generation. It wasn't karma. It wasn't God saying, your parents messed up, so now you're in trouble. Now I'm going to take it out on you. That's not a loving God. What he was saying is the parents don't follow. Here's what's going to happen. Slavery, exploitation, imperialism, pollution, immorality. All these things are examples of this principle. They're natural results just as they don't follow God's law. The parents don't follow, what's going to happen to the kids? The parents don't obey these commands that they receive and think about what some of these are, and then all of a sudden the kids don't have these. Well, what's going to happen? It's not God being hateful. It's consequences to not following him and trusting his ways. Dorothy Sayers, a mystery writer, is also a devoted Christian. And when attempting to explain the moral law of God, she pointed out that in our society there are two kinds of laws. She said there is a law of the stop sign and there's the law of the fire. The law of the stop sign is a law that says that traffic is heavy on a certain street, and as a result, the police department or city council, they put a stop sign up, and they determine how much it'll cost if you run the stop sign. And if traffic changes, they can change it. They can get rid of it. The highway comes up, they say, we don't need a stop sign anymore. The police department, the city council, controls the law of the stop sign. But then she said there's the law of the fire. And the law of fire says, if you put your hand on fire, in fire you're going to get burned, right? That's pretty easy. But now imagine that all of the legislators of all the nations of the entire world gathered together in a great assembly, and they voted unanimously to remove the law of fire. It's done. Now if you put your hand in fire, we're going to vote on it, and it's not going to burn you anymore. Now who's going to be the volunteer that tries this out? As everyone knows, the first person that puts their, that vote didn't work. That decision didn't work. Bound up in the nature of fire itself is the penalty for abusing it. It's not that the fire is hateful. It's a natural consequence. The moral law of God is like that of fire, she says. She says, you never break God's laws. You just break yourself on them. God can't reduce the penalty because the penalty for breaking the law is bound up in the law itself. And so what does this teach us about God then? That he's very wise and that we do well to follow him. It's a very simple principle. It carries over to today. Third commandment. This one feels a little bit different. Verse 7. You shall not misuse the name of the Lord your God, for the Lord will not hold anyone guiltless who misuses his name. You guys have heard of Romeo and Juliet, Shakespeare. Juliet says something about this. She says, what's in a name? That which we call a rose by any other name would smell just as sweet. In other words, a name doesn't matter. If you took a rose and you called it a skunk, it's still going to smell like a rose. The name doesn't mean anything. It's just what the object is, right? But in the Hebrew culture, that wasn't the case. A name mattered a lot. It was your identity. It was any power that you may have had. A name meant everything at the time. And our names today still give us identity, right? What comes to mind when I say the name LeBron James? Right, like maybe top 50 basketball player, definitely not number one because Jordan. But what if I said Joe Biden? Don't say it. Donald Trump. Hey, let's get the other half. I want to cause a little fight here. I don't want to do that. But when you hear a name, you have thoughts immediately. Right? You could do it to the extreme. You could say Mother Teresa. You're probably going to have some really good things to say about her. Or Adolf Hitler, and it's probably not going to be so good. A name means something. Does anybody know who Marion Robert Morrison is? Marion Robert Morrison. You know, yep. John Wayne. Yep. You can't be a cowboy named Marion. Right, so the name became John Wayne, so that he would have a different image. His name meant something to him. So how do we understand this third commandment then? If a name mattered so much, how would they misuse his name? Well, in Hebrew, you take something in vain, right? Instead of misusing, it means to use it for a worthless purpose. The ancient Israelites, they took God's name in vain whenever they did a couple things. They used his name in making an oath or a promise that they didn't keep. They used it in vain whenever they would mix worshiping God with other false gods. Maybe they would worship Yahweh, or that's our God, or Baal or Asherah, all at the same time, even in the same place. And that was wrong. Or they used it for their own personal gain. They would have never dreamed of how much we would have taken God's name in vain in our society. Really, if you think about it, there's a book called Taking God's Name in Vain by Stephen Carter. And he says this. He says, in truth, there's probably no country in the Western world where people use God's name quite as much or quite as publicly or for quite as many purposes as we Americans do, the third commandment notwithstanding. Few candidates for office are able to end their speeches without asking God to bless their audience or the nation or the great work we are undertaking. But everybody is sure the other side is insincere. Athletes thank God often on television after scoring the winning touchdown because, like some politicians, they like to think God is on their side. Churches put up huge billboards and take out ads in the paper. God's will is cited as a reason to be against gay rights or a reason to be for them. Everybody who wants to change America or who doesn't want it to change understands they use God's name and they understand the nation's love for God's name, which is why everybody uses it. We do that. We see it everywhere. When you hear someone say, God bless the nation, first thought, do they really mean that? Or I'm praying for you. Are you really, or are you just saying it? Are you just giving the image so that people look at you differently? Because God said very early on, don't do it. Don't misuse my name. If I'm not for it, if it's not of me, don't bring me into it. It's like when you go to the bank and you need a loan and you have to have maybe collateral to take out the loan. And they were using God as collateral, and he did not want to be used. He did not want to be the cosigner. They would say things like they would say, as surely as God lives, and then they would finish with whatever they wanted to say. Like if I said, as surely as God lives, the Cubs will win the World Series this year. We know that's never going to happen. They got lucky one time. Sorry, Cubs fans. Actually, this year, the Cardinals aren't looking great. So anyway, if I said that, as surely as the Cardinals live, as God, sorry, the Cardinals, they're a team. As surely as God lives, the Cardinals will not win the World Series. Or they will. I'm done. I can't talk. Let's say I say they will. But, and obviously this is light and it's kind of a joke, but now let's say they don't win. And I said, if as surely as God lives, they will win, and now they don't. What happens for someone who walks by and sees that and they, well, you said this, so does that mean that your God is not actually a God? Right? Something more serious, maybe, you know, probably where they would really try to gain from it. And they would say, if God lives, then this will happen. It's going to rain, and then it doesn't rain. And then they would say, well, then your God doesn't live. Right? So they were using it for their own gain to get credibility and tearing down God, tearing down his name and his image. And so what does this teach us about him? Why did he put this so high on the list? When someone misuses the name of God, or says it's of God, or it's because of him, he would just say, no, that's not me. Things like anger and hate towards other people and destroying in God's name, nope, he says, I'm out, and don't use my name for that. We need to know who God really is, and if other people are going to worship him and come to him and feel the grace and the love of God, then we can't mess that up. That's why it's so high on the list. All right, we get to number 4, verses 8 through 11. Remember the Sabbath day by keeping it holy. 6 days you shall labor and do all your work, but the seventh day is a Sabbath to the Lord your God. On it you shall not do any work, neither you, nor your son or daughter, nor your male or female servant, nor your animals, nor any foreigner residing in your towns. For in 6 days the Lord made the heavens and the earth, the sea, and all that is in them, but he rested on the seventh day. Therefore the Lord blessed the Sabbath day and made it holy. God gave Israelites freedom all 7 days, and he asks that they would give some of it back to him. Does he need it? No, this is what's best for them. It was set all the way in the example back to the creation. It says that God made the earth or made everything in 6 days and rested on the seventh. The Lord's instructions for collecting manna back when they were traveling, when they were still in the wilderness in chapter 16, they would collect manna 6 days. They would collect double on the sixth day, and then on the seventh day, they wouldn't collect anything. They wouldn't work at all. And God was trying to tell them, just trust me. Just you think you're going to have to collect extra. And you know what happened when they collect? Some of them decided to get too much, and there was maggots in it. God wanted them to know that we can trust him. Now, some of the conversations I was having after first service, because I didn't share some of this, and it's like, well, are we supposed to work on the seventh day? Are we supposed to take a day off, or do we have to? Is it a rule or not? This is a tough one. I don't want to take a command and say, you don't have to do it, and then you face God on Judgment Day, and he says, why didn't you take off the seventh day? And you could say, well, my minister told me not to. So I'm not going to say that. But there is a principle behind this. This is a gift from God for us. What he's saying is it's better to do this. You get this as a gift. Also, it's an act of trust. Do we trust that God will provide? Think about our lives, and we've got, you know, maybe a lot of people work 5 days a week for 8 or 10 hours a day, and then, though, they didn't go and collect a paycheck. They worked, and they fed their family, and if there was a drought and there wasn't rain, they're probably thinking, well, we can't go to the store. We're just going to die, right? So any chance that you had, you would have been working really hard to try to collect as much as you could, and you're trusting in your work. So God was saying, relax a little. Trust me, right? And then, so today, do you have to take the seventh day off? You know, I said I work on the seventh. I work every Sunday, and then one of the guys said, "Well, you call that work? I just am talking up here, but I have a different day off." Yeah, and it's an act of trust and an act of worship, and it's necessary and it's beneficial for us. And so this has been going on for a long time. Creation. They were the redemption from slavery in Deuteronomy 15, and then through Jesus in Hebrews 4. It points to that we have a different kind of rest. So what's this idea? Well, Jesus had a different understanding of the Sabbath as the religious leaders of his day. One day, Jesus was passing through grain fields on the Sabbath, and his disciples were hungry, so he began to pick heads of grain. And the religious leaders, they were mad. You can't do that. They had created a code of restrictions that basically said you couldn't do any work on the Sabbath. They had 39 articles which basically said that you couldn't break a sweat on the Sabbath. And so they asked him, Jesus, why are they breaking the Sabbath law? And Jesus responded this way. He reminded them of what King David did. They really admired King David when he and his friends were hungry. They entered the temple, and they ate consecrated bread, which was unlawful for anyone except for the priests. And then Jesus said this, and here's, I think, the principle. He was trying to say, guys, here was the law, and here's why it's here. He said, the Sabbath was made for man, and not man for the Sabbath. We're not made just to be a bunch of rule followers. We're made to do something different, to honor God and to love him and to trust him and obey him. And he says, and here's a gift. Paul, so after Jesus, Paul says to the Colossians, he said, let no one act as your judge in regard to food or drink in respect to a festival or a new moon or a Sabbath day, things which are a mere shadow of what is to come, but the substance belongs to Christ. So what he's saying is, don't judge someone else for what they're doing on it. You take this gift and you use it, and you use it to honor God. It tells us that he wants us to trust him, and that it's a gift and a time to remember and to worship and to come together. And like I said at the beginning, to sing songs. Well, why are we singing songs? I don't know if you ever have a song in your head. Does anybody get like songs in your head? Yeah, throughout the week. Like when we come together and sing this, you probably don't remember a lot of the stuff that I said when we walk. I don't remember what I said as soon as I get to lunch, but a song is going through my mind, and that's why we're very intentional about picking songs that remind us of the gospel and of God coming through, because when that hard time hits on Tuesday or Thursday, you're like, I don't know how we're going to pay for this, and I don't know what this test result's going to be, then it's a reminder, and it carries us through. So what do these rules mean for us today? I'm just about to be done here, and I want to read a quote from C.S. Lewis that helps, I think, to apply this. He said, when I have learnt to love God better than my earthly dearest, I shall love my earthly dearest better than I do now. Insofar as I learn to love my earthly dearest at the expense of God and instead of God, I shall be moving toward the state in which I shall not love my earthly dearest at all. When first things are put first, second things are not suppressed, but increased. We don't have to choose, am I supposed to love God or am I supposed to love family? Am I supposed to love God or am I supposed to love my job? God wants us to have it all together. He wants us to love God with our jobs and through our families and love people. That's why the list is both, love God and love people. But we have to love God first. I mean, just leave him out, you will not love people better. The closer you are to God, the more you'll be a better husband or wife. You'll be a better parent. You'll be a better coworker. It's just the way it works because of what God gives us. These rules are just rules, but they show us what matters, and they show us how we can love others more. We can't forget, though, to put him first. It's for him, and it's for us. All right. I am going to end a little differently today. I want to do a couple of things. I want to ask Jason to come forward first.